Thank you very much, Nicola, and thank you for coming again. And those who are not here, this will be a follow-up of the first lecture. Just to go back into the past, 1 week and 1 day ago, I discussed the background to the military in general, to leadership in generalship, and avoided any specific analyses of various pharaohs. But I did point out I wanted to choose three, and this first of them would be Thutmose III. Basically, I've chosen Thutmose III, Ramesses II, and Pianki because the amount of information given by them to us is large, quite large indeed, and we can therefore analyze what Thutmose III, say, for this lecture means. What does he actually represent? I've used as a title to chapter two, for this is chapter two that I'm going to present here, Thutmose III, colon, a strategic commander. And that's what I see him. I see him less as a hero in terms of a great, awe-inspiring leader of men, and more as a commander-in-chief who is strategically brilliant. And this is how I would consider him, as he wants he to be, as he wants himself to be for us. And to remind you, those who were here before, that is the point I stressed earlier, that we can only go on, we can only use the information we have as what the pharaohs present, as what these great leaders present. Now, in the first lecture, I did describe and cover certain parameters. These are the technical parameters that all military historians use. Distance, supplies, time, expenditure, and the like. And I set up the situation that by this era, the era of Thutmose III, you had already in place a well-defined strategic network of highways and byways, main routes and minor roads that were used and organized specifically for the Egyptian army, for the Egyptian travelers, and in particular that of the Sinai corridor. So assumed here of Thutmose III in his famous campaign is that already in place were the arteries or the veins, if you will, of an administrative, social, and military nature or setup that could be utilized at any time. Therefore, Thutmose III, in a sense, had inherited not merely the campaigns or campaign of his predecessors, but even more the roots and the organizational background. And when I say he's a strategic commander, let me be very specific here. I have brought up the fact that traditionally in military historians, and for also, excuse me about this cough, the whole situation of warfare, it was traditional to define things as strategy on top and underneath, or on the bottom to be precise, tactics. But as it developed, the field of military history, and I presume also as warfare developed in the 20th century, you have what is called the operational level or operational arts underneath the actual strategic. And I define that as how to organize the strategy and not how to fight in particular. Now, what Thutmose III had at his fingertips were parameters that we know. The velocity of the army, how long did it take the Egyptian army to march, which is presumably 5 to 6 hours each day, averaging around 3 to 4 kilometers. Also, fodder. I pointed out that it would be too expensive and was not really necessary to bring baggage trains of a lot of food, or even a moderate amount of food, except for the Sinai, which is a different issue. Once the Egyptian army got to Gaza, and Thutmose III places really the beginning of his march northwards at Gaza, everything was secured for the quality of fodder. Now, fodder has to be more specifically defined, and I won't do that here. I have done it in an analysis here as to the type of food you need for horses, the type of food you need for oxen, the type of food you need for donkeys and the like. And it is crucial to recognize that the Egyptians first lived off the land, but at the same time, dry fodder had to be brought over, with them in order to supply the animals. Water now is not something you can simply pick up or assume that a city, a hamlet, a town will provide. You have the necessity per person of day of around 4 liters. And so water supply, though highly important, even by myself or anyone else in Egyptology, has never been discussed. Supply trains. Here again, I had to depend more on what the classical historians of ancient warfare describe and analyze. Where are the battle trains? Where is all of the supply that is going? We don't see much of it, even in the Kadesh inscriptions and reliefs of Ramesses II, and we don't hear about the baggage trains at all. They would slow down, and in particular, thinking of what Thutmose III is going to have to encounter here, as he tries to get to the city of Megiddo, sorry, it's the top one, over here, and decides to choose a certain path to get to Megiddo through that mountainous territory that you can see here, you would still have to supply animals, and more particularly humans as well, as with food. So the rate of progress for the animals and the army have to be taken into consideration. And I concluded that roughly for 5 to 6 hours a day, with an average velocity of 3 to 4 kilometers per hour, we could do an advance of around 22 kilometers per day, which is quite high, I feel, for the time. Now note as well the terrain, and I just give you the first map, the topography to Megiddo. Was this known to the Egyptians? And the answer is it must have been. The king assumes that he knows the routes. He doesn't know them by having crossed over them or traversed them in person, but he knows them by information. So behind this campaign, this famous campaign of Thutmose III, directed against the core city of Megiddo, this place over here, you have an assumption, and the assumption is that the Egyptian chancellery, the army, the administrators, if you will, the spies, have all reported back and have provided enough information that a strategic goal can be reached, that's the city of Megiddo, through certain operational means, through marching on land, of course, but taking certain routes, to ensuring that the army is of a certain size. And my assumption now has upped it, has raised it to around 7,500 on the basis of some new information on the size of the chariots employed and the like. Here on the map, you have the basic parameters given to you. I have not provided the kilometer thing diagram. There you have Megiddo, and there you have Yehem, where the famous conference will be taken. And there you have the routes crossing into the plain, of which the city of Megiddo is just at the point of it. And here everything will come to a point. What is interesting in the account is that the king preferred to give what I call a ratchet approach, an approach giving specific dates based on the war diaries and specific events, as if you move to a level plain and then up like a step and then go to another step. So its literary aspect is, in a sense, not continuous as a line going up. If you wanted to write, or if the Egyptians could want to write as they would, a narrative account that is free-flowing. Thutmose III chose this means, a step means, I guess like a pyramid at the gray. It's up and up and up. It's a simple approach in terms of the literary aspect, but it also means that the king not only has the interest and the involvement and the determination to present a certain means of narrative, but he actually does that in order to ensure that a specific day, the events surrounding, not the battle, but as much more as the war conference took place. And it's in the so-called annals, as everyone calls them, that you have, and I'll follow a translation of Donald Redford here, His Majesty ordered a consultation with his victorious army, saying. And what you have is that the narrative suddenly goes into a specific discussion, the words from the Pharaoh come out. And it's as if one is reading, or at least remembering, parallels in Greco-Roman history, in military history from the Greeks and the Romans, in which the action ceases and you have what are called set speeches, set directions in direct speech, sometimes involving negative, and also the third will provide negative comments, and sometimes involving a discussion. Now, all too often, this type of setting, and it is a narrative setting for Moses III, where he's at, to remind you, Yehem, over here. Or here, where you have, again, the roads better, perhaps, written down without the topography given, but there you have Megiddo, the two roads up here, and the choice of what Moses III did, having determined way back down here. So we're here with the kilometers at least, these are miles. This is British, 1943. Miles given to you and the routes he could have taken. It's interesting that you have a choice of three, as if you're in a fairy tale or the like, where you choose one, the second, and must choose the third or the like, but it happens to be the case. Whether this is done purposefully or not, I don't wish to discuss. However, I wish to highlight, emphasize, concentrate upon this literary background of where the king says, the vile enemy of Kadesh, this is the enemy, having come down, has now entered Megiddo, and he's there at this very moment. What you had is therefore a coalition assembled against the Egyptian control over Palestine. Whatever the control was, weak, strong, indirect, firm, is not the issue, or it should not be the issue for us or for him. Tutmosis III had to face that the enemy at Megiddo had decided to make a coalition of the various city-states in Palestine and Syria. And the enemy, therefore, that Tutmosis III was facing or is facing at this very moment is not a unified one, and that's often been overlooked. It's a coalition, a collection, an assembly, so to speak, of various kings or kinglets, princes from Palestine in particular, all having come together at the city of Megiddo. There's a list of them given, and some of them do involve city-states outside of Palestine proper. And the king then asks his troops for his opinion. Now, when he says he asked his troops, he obviously means he's asked the highest officials. He has a war conference. And these type of war conferences, to repeat myself, are typical in the historical accounts of the Greeks and the Romans in antiquity. In that type of classical scenario, literary backdrop, the words are not real, but they're assumed to reflect the intention of the commander-in-chief, Tutmosis III, as well as the feelings and emotions of himself, his opponents, and his troops as well. And I think this is done equally, but not to such a heightened degree, by the Egyptians themselves in these so-called annals. And the king then says, and he gives the alternatives, why go to the north? Why go to the south? The troops themselves must have, although it's never given in the account, the king must have sent out earlier scouts or spies to examine the entranceways from number one, the eventual route number two, and number three, to ensure that there is not a sizable number of troops there. How else? This is left unsaid in the account. But any normal general on the march, strategic commander, as I call Tutmosis III, would have done that automatically. You would have had scouts sent out before, on horses, not on chariots, not on donkeys, one per one horse per one man, or one man per one horse. And they would have left very early. They could have left before daybreak, and they have to go up and then come back. So again, from a, let me say, a mathematical point of view, I've examined the distances from Yehem to the first one, which is the Tanakh route, then the route the Egyptian army will take place, the narrow Aruna Pass, because it comes out there, and the road to Jeftah, and just pinpointed in terms of time, a scout going here, and then the scout has to come back, you see. So the time expenditure is quite large when you get to the third route. This would have been done beforehand, and it could have been done before the entire Egyptian army had reached here. You send the scouts out before. They'd live off the land. It's one person per horse. That could be easily done. And the king says there are two roads, and this is one road. The army says no, it comes to the south. The other one is north. You can see at Jeftah. And this is what the army prefers, or the high officials prefers. Now, this type of decision-making that I stress at Yehem itself, at this war conference, has often been called the royal novel. This is a term that's been developed in the field of Egyptology. I'd like just to stop here for a moment on that. It's called Koenig's Novella because the person who used it for the first time was a German scholar in 1938. It's used all the time. It's used repeatedly in scholarship. It's used and used and used till I feel it's been overused. I don't like the term often as it's employed by modern scholars or even by outsiders because it's a title, it's a rubric, it's a heading that disguises what actually is underneath. What is underneath is a real attempt to move to the crux or the crisis. The crisis in the Battle of Megiddo isn't the battle. The crisis is here, at least 2 or 3 days before the battle itself. It's the decision-making that Tutmosis III wants you to know, wants us to know, that occurred there, where the choices were given by his high officials, south, middle, south or north, and his choice was in the middle. It's as simple as that. And the reasons given are positive. It's safer, it's quicker to take the southerly route. We know, says the troops, that the army is going to be outside of Megiddo anyway, so we can sneak this way and come up, or we can bypass and come down. Now, the Egyptians themselves appear to have well recognized that this was easy to march on. There was no opposition. In fact, no opposition ever occurred. The scouts would have told the Egyptian army that Tutmosis III went to the middle path, the Aruna Pass path, and met basically no opposition aside from some enemies. The expected battle itself would have not have been an infantry battle, but to remind you from the last lecture, would have been a chariot battle at first, and I will return to this at the end of the lecture, what type of battle was preferred. They always want a chariot battle. The elite of the army, remembering my words 8 days ago, were chariot soldiers. And therefore, you must have one. You must have an encounter. You must have a chariot encounter. And ideally, the best place is outside of a major city, which would be Megiddo. This is what actually will occur or had occurred. So, in fact, that is the hallmark of the campaign. And yet, the real hallmark is this conference that's occurring in which Tutmosis III is a general who ascertains time and space as two logistical modes in war. His reasons for preferring, if you will, the Aruna Pass or Middle Road, the one there, are given to us. And this is what he wants. He always will tell us exactly what he prefers. This is the battle itself. Here again is perhaps a better reconstruction, the general way that has occurred, and it looks very nice on the map. Remember my comments about how not to trust Egyptological maps, which I presented in the first lecture. They look nice. You have two arrows over here, du flèche over here, always done nicely, up, up, and then through there. Of course, he would be marching here, and he would go through here. But this map, which is one for me, does not tell you what preceded it. Where did the king get the information? Was it simply on his own maps, his cart, or as I suspected, the background of the topography, the general geographic zone, was known through the Egyptian administrative structure for many, many years. But specifically, he had his own troops determining what would happen. So what you have here is therefore the fulfillment, before the battle has even occurred, of the three necessary criteria for a successful campaign, for a successful pharaoh, for a successful general. A defined goal strategically. So there's your strategically, to defeat the enemy coalition. It's clear. There's no haze. There's no smoke. There's no fog. There's no confusion. I must defeat an enemy which is chariot-based outside the city of Megiddo. The enemy knew this very well, as I'm remembering my last lecture. So, therefore, it is an all-or-nothing situation. Thutmose III must defeat the enemy there to fulfill everything. If he loses, everything is lost. So he must bring along a larger number of troops and chariots and horses than would have occurred earlier. Now, operationally, here we go directly into the conference at Yehem, the city on the southerly portion of this map. A certain degree of operational flexibility was present. That is to say, you had choices. You weren't locked in or focused on one road. You had choices there. So you do have independent decisions being made there. And that's why Thutmose III is so much better seen as a strategic commander who works operationally very successfully. It is a risky nature, and Thutmose III's generals or high officials in the army state that in particular. They are fearful of what could occur. It's narrow, the Aruna Pass. I have one picture for you soon. You have to dismantle the chariots. You have to put horse after horse, instead of having horse on left and on right and horse on left. And then the donkeys would have to equally march in a file situation. And now with regard to the tactical level, well, there's the battle. We can't describe the tactics of war until we reach the actual plain outside the city of Megiddo. So Thutmose III would have to have a large enough army. How is this done? I used to say it was 5,000. I've moved it up somewhat. Other people put it higher, not too higher. How did he determine it? He traveled along well-defined roads. He had to ensure the safety of the Egyptian army, that is, after leaving Gaza northwards. He had to ensure the provisioning. And he had to, perhaps even more important, attempt to verify any unexpected enemy encampment in operations, which is why I would maintain that scouts were employed and traveling at a good speed and not sticking at any specific city. In fact, if you note the route that he takes, it's a simple one. It goes through key cities. He doesn't stop there very long. Gaza, for example, is one day. It always surprised me. Thutmose III leaves the delta. He gets to Gaza overnight, and then he's marching. He doesn't delay, so he's not getting bogged down into any details and the like. So I think in a general reconstruction, we can see clearly what the type of progress the king would make. As for the reconstructions of the battle, this is the route. And then I skipped over this, so I'll go back. This is a 1943 reconstruction of Raymond Faulkner's, who places it in a typical military sense of using rectangles, see, enemy. Egyptians are white, and he has some chariots there. I don't think this can be done. It's the type of chariot battle that I'll have to return to once more there. But there's a more recent analysis of the enemy. The enemy, you see, has provided, according to this, and that is correct, troops here and troops at Megiddo, and the Egyptians are coming up this way. That's a general exposition. As for the battle, then it's placed in this way, a more recent exposition of the battle that you can see. But it remains the case that I cannot provide you with an actual reconstruction, because the battle itself is not emphasized to remind us more. A hypothetical placement of where the Egyptian chariotry would have been has been given in 2015 and published a year later in 2016. Here is a good example of it, where the chariotry is supposed to be placed with the triangles and the like. I don't know if the Egyptians did it. Here is the Aruna Pass. It is significant that it has, this is the first, for me anyway, it is significant it has been rarely photographed, and this is the first one that actually appeared in any publication dealing with ancient Egypt. Inside, never. Outside, here. And one can gather, it isn't difficult to march up. It's narrow, is it not? Granted, this is modern, but still it's narrow. And at least it isn't paved here very much. You can see immediately that you could not live off the land, so supplies were important, and therefore the hidden, always hidden in the Egyptian accounts, of the supply train is not given to us. The conference here I now present to you. There it is on day 16. He arrives at the city of Yehem, and he has a choice. And this is the narrative high point. It is the dramatical high point. In a sense, classically, if you have a drama, a play of five acts, you're putting the high point not at the end in Act 4 or early Act 5, you're putting it in the middle. In a sense, it's like Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. The high point of Julius Caesar is his assassination. And that's not in Act 5, that's not in Act 4, that's Act 3. And so you are 50% through a play in which the audience grasps the real crux of the event, namely Caesar's assassination. Well, in a sense, in terms of the length of the text, you see you're up into lines, or columns to be more precise, 20 and 25, 30 and 35. You have over 80 columns in which the first 25 move you to the high point, the zenith of the intent. And this is the man coming to the fore. This is Thutmose III coming to the fore. What he wants, what he states, what he intends to present to us, what he emphasizes in his text. And to a large extent, I've gone over the account following a more recent one. This again is Raymond Faulkner's. I followed Redford's, but I had to change to some degree his interpretations of the key events. I don't believe there's any opposition. What you have to is an interesting switch. I find this very interesting. As the narrative proceeds from the beginning of the account of the king's departure from Egypt, through Gaza and then up to the Aruna Pass, he is always depicted as His Majesty, to use the term, in the third person. When he's speaking, of course, that is direct speech. So he's giving his words in the first person, and the army in return are giving their words in the first person, plural. But the, if you will, direct speech interlude or expressions are part and parcel of any piece of literature, any narrative. Suddenly, however, in an impersonal aspect, the narrative switches. Instead of His Majesty marching, then it's My Majesty marched. And there's one important subsection in the composition in which the narrative, not the direct speech, not the quotes, not the words of the Pharaoh and his army, but rather the impersonal, if you will, editor looking at the narrative, makes the king into a first person. My Majesty did this and My Majesty did that. This occurs specifically when the conference is finished. The king has gone up to the Aruna Pass and he's going to go into it, and the account becomes involved with the gods of Egypt for the first and only time. And thus we meet a direct intervention, albeit circumspect, but nevertheless a direct intervention of the deities, the gods of Egypt, involved and supporting Thutmose III, albeit for a short period of time, but significantly when the narrator decides he doesn't want the third person, impersonal, ordinary, His Majesty reached, His Majesty arrived, His Majesty slept, His Majesty woke up, to My Majesty went forward at the head of the army. My Majesty entered the Aruna Pass with the aid of Amun-Ra and the like. This only occurs once in the lengthy annals of Thutmose III and ceases the minute the army is in Megiddo, is in the Aruna Pass and does not return. And I will have to discuss those type of, if you will, interventions later in the third lecture, but I'd like to highlight that point now because it was often never discussed. What is discussed is the conference, which the remaining two slides will deal with. Here it is, and I point it out to you because it is the, if you will, key to the entire composition. It is probably the composition section that is the most interesting to us because it reveals a bit of the personality of the king, similarly a bit of the personality of the soldiers. It reveals the topography, the roads, where they are, where they go to. It reveals perhaps even more the intent, the overriding strategic intent of the pharaoh as a strategic commander, which is what he wants you to know. This is what he considers himself to be. Up to now, he's not viewing himself as a great warrior. He's not interested in telling you how many enemies he will or has or presently is massacring, killing, or capturing. He's not interested to tell you the type of control or type of imperialistic aspects of Egyptian control he has. He's interested in specific information that the army would be interested in, namely the data, the strategic data of the campaign. And this is what he does. He is caught, I find interesting, by the army, which specifically says, yes, you are always at the head of the army, the kings have to be, and you speak at the head of the army, you command at the head of the army, you leave it. But when you come out of the Aruna Pass, and so maybe it's good to go back to the Aruna Pass here. When you come out of the Aruna Pass, let's go back to this one. Here, ensure that you don't go ahead of the army, you stay behind. So the king remains at the end of the pass to see all of the troops pass by. He doesn't go on to the city of Megiddo. He remains at the exit, so to speak, of the Aruna Pass. But the army states that's what they want him to do. So they put a stipulation up, which I find in itself interesting that it's just given to us. And as for the pass itself, it's nice to read the commentary. Here's it on the day two, and I'll just read a few words. You can see the king is going to swear, and he mentions the gods here as if they are going to be involved, and Amun, Lord of the Thrones of the Two Lands, is present, and he's going to discuss it. And then he wakes up on day 19, and he goes north. So for the two slides here, the conference actually carries two pages, carries a bit more than you would have expected in the account. You would have expected normally the king to have decided to go into the pass and then come out. And it leads one to questions which you might want to ask me. Was there a dispute? I don't think there was, but was there, and the like, or was the king not quite decided, and then he decides suddenly. Remembering that to go through the pass, you have to dismantle the chariots, taking care of the horses, seeing the extended army in a file through there in a dangerous situation, you have to gauge the time it would take, and then to reassemble the army after you leave the pass. It's not enough in the pass, but when you come out, what do you do? And then moving on to Megiddo. So it is correct to say that the troops of the king, the high officials, were right in pointing out the dangerous position of the king's wish to take the Aruna Pass. Eventually he gets to the battlefield itself, and if you wish a reconstruction, I will go back to this one, since this is Faulkner here. But as I say, I cannot go any further than saying these are hypothetical reconstructions and do not help us to determine the orientation of the pharaoh. This is simply a modern reconstruction. I believe that the king waited for the assembly at Megiddo, and that probably on the 21st of a certain month, in the morning, the battle will take place. Remembering, please, what I had brought up about 8 days ago in terms of how the battle pieces always nicely are placed outside of a fortress citadel, outside of a city. It looks clear day, there's no problems. You have the king in the chariot fighting the army. And this is actually what you seem to have at the Battle of Megiddo. It's what they would do. It is a set battle. The walls are shut up, the gates are locked, the chariots of the enemy are there, and it's a chariot on chariot battle. And for the first time, you can actually perhaps try to reconstruct the type of battle, not by foot soldiers, but by chariotry. Now, I can give you further information on chariots that I did not do in the last lecture. I purposely avoided the use of chariots because I felt that Thutmose III is a good case to bring up in connection with these war vehicles. They were certainly good for operational levels, owing to their maneuverability, surprise, and firepower, but they required intelligence and training as well as leadership qualities. Hence, the elite nature of this army formation, the chariot formation, was a logical outcome of their presence in combat. But they are also vulnerable when there was poor or no infantry support, had a limited application, and were logistic dependencies. The chariots were not tanks, despite the fact that some people still write, and I think some people even most recently have viewed them as sort of helicopters in battle. I don't see them at all that way. How did they fight? Well, remembering what I brought up in the last lecture, I said there are two alternatives, straight on or encircling. But to be honest, and any Egyptologist would have to agree, and in fact any historian of the second millennium BC dealing with the Hittites or with Babylon and Assyria would also have to agree, we don't have any manuals. We don't have any manuals on the tactics of chariot warfare. They don't exist. All we have is for Thutmose III being victorious immediately in the chariot battle without understanding why. Was it simply numbers or the cohesion of the Egyptian troops? And what I feel, the lack of unity of the coalition of the enemies at the city of Megiddo. So I cannot go any further than that, but point out to the necessity of the Egyptians to have a large number of chariots. With a recent text that has been translated by Colleen Manessa, we can now at least estimate the number of enemy chariots better. They come to 1,900, and hypothesized that the Egyptian chariots should, I would say, be double somewhat amount around that, and therefore the total troops with infantry would be around 7,500. Now, those of you that would like to know about how did the horses act in the chariots, let me say that it isn't easy to, as people think, to kill them. We have no evidence for this. The endurance of any active horse lasts for about 1 hour or two at the most. And you have to remember, it's very difficult, although the Egyptian evidence, and you shall see more of it next week, shows javelins in the sides of the animals. Arrow wounds do not kill a horse. In contrast, for those who are interested, if they're maimed by arrows, lances, or javelins, they and other body piercings actually stimulate the horse, and it takes hours before they die. So the use of chariots has to be put into the context that the bowman, the archer in the vehicle of the chariot is aiming at a man and not at a horse. They're not putting arrows into the horses. I know some of the scenes have spears or lances into the horse's sides. That doesn't kill a horse. And also I know that the spears and lances are in other humans as well. So one must take that into consideration in the battle itself. But that's all I could actually give to you, it's all I can really give to you from this literary account. They don't provide the personal aspects of the king's warfare. It's quite different. That is, the annals of Thutmose III at Megiddo presents a case quite different from that of Ramesses II in battle. In Ramesses II, the king is heroic in battle. In Thutmose III, he's far less heroic because the significant nature he's giving to you and to me is his decision-making, his strategic command of strategy plus the operational theater. This is what he wants us to know, and this is what leads to the success. Although I believe that you have the problem of coalitions. So let me go into that. The battle is considered to be a quasi-success for those who were interested in it, although the enemy was destroyed and the city went under siege. It was considered a quasi-success because Thutmose III's troops plundered, and that's given in the account, plundered the camps of the enemies. Yes, that is a situation that did the king want? No. The king wanted an immediate success. And did he really punish the army? Not that I see. Nevertheless, it's the success in battle that I'm interested by Thutmose III. The enemy itself had divided troops. If I go back to at least an early map here, the troops of the king that the king had to face was set up to the north, south, and the center. So the enemy had already divided its troops. The opponents themselves would have had, therefore, a reduced number of soldiers at Megiddo. I would assume the best were there, but still it was reduced, the number. The enemy was not united. This I want to re-stress here. The factor appears not to have been discussed. The opponents were disunited because they formed a coalition of rebels. But once a defeat was certain in the troops themselves, in the coalition of enemy troops, once the defeat was certain, the individual city units of the coalition split from one another. This is what I assume would have occurred, because there's no overriding unity there. Once it's realized by you that the battle is lost and that you can leave the field, escape, so to speak, because it's a coalition, you will break away more easier than it was a unified army, such as Thutmose III's, where you can't break away simply because parts of your own Egyptian army are being defeated. And one must recognize that unity is a preeminent requirement for an army as well as for an alliance. And that's really, I think, the important point that you can garner, that you can actually determine from this account. So I describe, but I won't provide here, what is necessary for unity against another group, an enemy that is by definition unified, such as Egyptians versus the Asiatics. Now, it's interesting that if you deal with this as, again, modern military historians do, they like to view warfare as moving quick and stopping, ceasing, in movement, pausing, and then you have a quick pause, or a quick pause. And this occurs very neatly for Megiddo, for this whole battle of Thutmose III. It links itself, it connects itself with modern understandings of progress of warfare. And people from an outside are always mystified why things suddenly go very fast and then nothing happens for days, weeks, and months. Well, this example of Megiddo provides perfectly the operational nature of warfare. You have the king arriving at Yehem and a pause. Pauses in the narrative too. You have then the determination of the operational plans, penetrating the Aruna Pass. And then there's a pause before the battle. And then you have the battle, and then you have a pause after the battle, which had to occur. The king's troops are plundering the camp, the battle is over, and then you go to a siege, and additional military actions of a lesser nature occur. And thus you have movement, pause, movement, pause, movement, pause, very well represented by the narrative of Thutmose III, owing to this, I think, well-planned account. In summary then, because this is what I really would like to end up with, how do we describe the king? How do we analyze him? First, he clearly is interested in the operational nature of warfare. He seems to be more interested in that than the actual battle, as he writes to us. It's only we can do. Second, he seems to be highly competent, visually competent, three-dimensionally competent in strategic commands. And thus I feel it is somewhat incorrect to call him a great hero of battle, although that's what Egyptologists like to do. I regard him as a successful, heroic, if you will, strategic commander. So I'm defining him more narrowly based on the conference that we have at Yehem down here. His use of narrative means that one does not have deep dramatic overtures in the account. By using the war diary as an approach, by the stepped means of time and place, by and large, you don't have emotions of any nature, personal or otherwise, coming in. You do have somewhat of a dispute between what path to take, but it is not an emotional one. So evaluating him, and that's all that I can do of this Dynasty 18 pharaoh, and you have to eventually assess the individual, you can talk about his actor ability, perhaps, at Yehem in the conference, where he's commanding the conference to determine a policy that was not thought of by the troops. So there you can point out his personality, but it refers back again to a strategic decision. It isn't garnering the troops, bringing the troops up to battle fury. It is rather saying, I'm choosing this path for this reasons. And thus it's perhaps more intellectual or it's more operational in this. He desired to have this specified. The account in all is on the actual war conference and not on the battle itself. And what's even more, it's not on the king's ability within the battle as much as his ability before the battle, 3 days before at Yehem. And thus I would stop here and summarize him by my general title of Thutmose III as, this is neutral as the chapter heading, as a strategic commander. In summary, I think he's an excellent strategic commander. Thank you very much.